History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you had to choose a job that represented what America was as sort of a mascot of America, which one would you choose? A lot of people would say something like a cowboy, maybe a soldier, maybe a policeman or a baseball player. Or you might choose something else like a competitive food eater, sort of like a Guy Fieri or someone who just goes to random dive restaurants. You could also choose jobs that are unique to the strange corporate culture of the United States, maybe a vice president, something that sounds like it's important, but really once you get above the level of manager in a large corporation, you become a vice president, maybe assistant to the regional manager, some weird job title. Well, this question of what job, what profession is the mascot of the United States, for a 100-year period from the 1880s to the 1980s approximately, if you ask this question, a lot of people would answer with this: a mountain man, somebody who traps furs and beavers, who lives completely away from settlements in the United States, lives out in the American West among American Indians. Okay, well, why mountain man? Out of all professions, why would people choose this? There's a lot of reasons, but what it comes down to is that many considered mountain men to be the complete distillation of the American frontier. And it was the American frontier that made the United States so distinct. This is what created the identity of the United States. And the purest distillation of the identity of the United States of the frontier is the mountain man. Now, this view fell out of favor as theories of what was the unifying identity of the United States also changed. But mountain men, and there weren't that many of them. There were only really about 1,500 who were thought to occupy this profession in the way that it was understood to be. There weren't that many of them, but they play a super outsized role in the history of the United States. The reason I'm tackling this topic has to do with a question from listener Josh Reddick, and he says, "Hi, Scott. I was wondering if you could answer a question for me. What was the most famous or interesting mountain man in the early American West? I'm very interested in the West during the 1800s, especially the less well-known, interesting facts and people." Well, that's a great question. So in this episode, what I'm going to be doing is looking at what the job of a mountain man was, also what was the perception of them, and why they're considered to be the embodiment of America. Okay, so let's start off with the basic question. What was the job of a mountain man? This profession came into existence after the Lewis and Clark expedition. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led the first expedition of white explorers across the western half of North America from 1804 to 1806. From then, from the reports of Lewis and Clark, they said that the West was teeming with beavers. And this was important because beaver pelts were what made beaver fur hats, and beaver fur hats were all the rage in Europe. One beaver pelt could fetch about $100, which was well more than the monthly wages of a sailor. It was about 2 to 3 months of a sailor's wages. If you collected enough beaver pelts, you could become fabulously rich. And those who read the reports of Lewis and Clark wanted to go out and make their fortune. So after forging routes through the wilderness, mountain men played a large role in the Western migration of American settlers. They would capture beaver pelts in the wilderness, in Oregon, in California, and elsewhere. But hunting for beaver in the American West was difficult and dangerous. It required a certain type of rugged individual to forge pathways through the Western wilderness far outside of any kind of help. This is even way more rugged than the Wild West era. The Wild West, this is a period in which there are a number of towns and settlements outside the protection and reach of the United States government and territories. Well, this period of mountain men trapping in the 1820s, 1840s is even before the Wild West time when there aren't even any really settlements. It's just individual explorers going out. Things really start in 1822 when businessman William Henry Ashley, the lieutenant governor of Missouri, placed a newspaper ad calling for 100 enterprising young men. who ascend the River Missouri to its source, there to be employed for 1, 2, or 3 years. The men who responded to this ad became known as mountain men. And there's only about 1,500 who held this position, who responded to the call of William Henry Ashley. And of course, there are other people that you could call mountain men, if we use the term more loosely, who lived in the wilderness, who lived in a hut by themselves and lived off the land. But if we're looking at the position as it was traditionally understood, who responded to the call of William Henry Ashley, this is who they were. Most mountain men worked for Ashley, and most only received a portion of the proceeds of their catch. What Ashley supplied to them in turn was the equipment to trap beaver, the startup cost or the startup capital. Another group called Ashley's Free Trappers didn't receive any wages and didn't have to pay Ashley anything, but he met these fur hunters, or one of his agents met them in the mountains, and bought their furs at a fixed price. These meetings were called rendezvous, French for get-together, to collect furs and resupply the trappers, so the trappers didn't have to come back into settlements and they were able to remain in beaver country year-round and not have to undergo the long and dangerous journey from the mountains, California, Oregon, elsewhere, all the way back east. So every summer from 1825 to 1840, there was a 4 to 6 week rendezvous, and it was wild. It was like a medieval feast. There was trade, there was recreation. Supply trains of mules and wagons came from Missouri. Think of it like a caravan going through the Silk Road, go to a destination, do all the trade, and then go back to the east. And a year's trade was accomplished in one time. And there was a lot of partying. A lot of mountain men spent most of the money they received for the whole year's take on drinking and entertainment. It's like a sailor blowing all his money at shore leave. Let's dig in a little more into what the profession of mountain men looked like. Many of them married American Indian women. Made sense because these were the people that they fraternized with and socialized with most. Their new wives knew how to live their lifestyle. They would shy away from it the way a woman from New York might. They learned the American Indian life and customs. This explains the dress that we see where men are dressed in buckskin. They have coonskin caps. It's a way to adopt American Indian dress to the dress that they were accustomed to. They also wore their hair long. They grew beards. They had weathered features. But despite relations they might have with natives, with American Indians, there were still about 500 mountain men who were killed over 3 decades. Maybe they're due to cultural misunderstandings or whatever. Others died in accidents or severe weather. Well, despite these hardships, many of them were successful. By 1840, many of the American beaver had been killed. The species was almost wiped out. But that was a moot point because by then, the beaver hat was going out of style and the fur trade was finished. But there was something new for mountain men to do. Westward expansion was opening up. There was a flood of people to Oregon in the 1830s when the Oregon Trail grew due to an American economic depression that pushed many out west to seek a new life for themselves. And with the huge spike in migration to California in the 1840s, many of the people who were the guides to these pioneers were mountain men. They led pioneers over roads that they themselves had created, and they played a key role in opening up the West for U.S. settlement. Okay, so that's what mountain men did. It's pretty straightforward. There's not a lot to explain there. Let's get in more into the meta picture of the perception of them and their outsized role in the imagination of the United States. With the growth of the Rocky Mountain fur trade in the 1830s, mountain men, even at this early date, captured the American imagination. They symbolized the freedom, the frontier, and to others, they represented anarchy. In the book The Prairie, written in 1827, James Fenimore Cooper's trapper hero, Leatherstocking, possesses natural virtue, sort of like the unspoiled innocence before the fall in America. America in innocence in a state of nature. But others thought of mountain men as corrupt renegades, like conquistadors who commit violence on locals. Timothy Flint's The Shoshone Valley, written in 1830, which was the first novel to feature mountain men as characters, wrote that they had an instinctive fondness for the reckless savage life, interdicted by no laws or difficult morals or any restraints. The German-American novelist and travel writer Charles Sealsfield wrote his book Life in the New World in 1844, and he described mountain men as violent and cunning, who killed with a real fiendish joy. So the debate surrounding the character of mountain men was a debate about America in its Western territories. Was the frontier a place of independence where man innocently found his true state of nature and he expressed his courage and heroism as an explorer? Or was it a place where, without the benefit of society, worlds broke down and people were savage and brutish and like animals? Let's look at one person just to see how these different values play out. One of the most legendary mountain men was Christopher Carson, known as Kit Carson, and he became famous as John Fremont's scout during his expeditions in the West, and then as Fremont's dispatch bearer in the Mexican War. In Fremont's reports of his expeditions into the Rocky Mountains and Oregon and Northern California, which were published in the 1840s, Carson appears as a figure out of one of these books. He's brave but humble. He's a man of the wilderness. So Carson became the subject of biographies and novels and sketches. Kind of like the figure of Daniel Boone, Carson's character reflected different types of interpretations of the West, and he was the West personified. He appears, on one hand, as a refined man of virtue and an agent of civilization. In the book by DeWitt C. Peters called The Life and Adventures of Kit Carson, written in 1858, Carson appears like a crude mountain man, but he goes beyond this caricature, and Peters writes, "He contracted no bad habits, but learned the usefulness and happiness of resisting temptation." Carson, in another biography, is depicted as a man who never drank liquor and carefully saved his money. But he also appears in popular literature as the self-reliant man of action. A noble figure of the hunter horseman, possessing a look of profound indifference to all and all the conscious confidence of ennobling self-reliance. Another person even claimed that Carson was the first to discover gold at Sutter's Mill in California, leading to the gold rush. In the real life, Carson went on to serve as a Civil War general and federal administrator in New Mexico. So he was sort of he was a folk hero to those in the American West and those going out West to try to find their claim and embodying all the virtues that it took to succeed out there. But other historians argue that he took part in atrocities against the Navajo, so that complicates his legacy. Let's look at another mountain man. Another famous person is John Coulter, who was born in Virginia. And he first went west in 1804 when he went on a journey to the Pacific Ocean and back as part of the Lewis and Clark expedition. 2 years in the wilderness was more than enough for most of the members of this expedition. But as they made their way home in 1806, Coulter decided to leave civilization as he knew it behind completely and begin his career as a fur trapper. He established himself as one of America's original mountain men and may have been one of the first white men to see Yellowstone National Park. There's a section of the Wyoming Shoshone River even known as Coulter's Hell, due to his description of the geothermal activity. He was wounded while fighting alongside Crow and Flathead tribesmen, but one of the most legendary periods in his life came in 1809, when he was captured by a band of Blackfeet while trapping in Montana. The Indians stripped Coulter naked, gave him a brief head start, and then chased after him as though he were wild game. So he ignored the cacti and rocks shredding his feet, and supposedly outran most of the warriors before he disarmed his closest pursuer and killed him with his own lance. He then staggered into a fort days later, walking over 200 miles, clothed only in a blanket. He participated in a few more fur trapping missions and had more run-ins with the Blackfeet before he retired to a Missouri farm in 1810. So these accounts in isolation don't add up to much, but taken all together, they represent a view of the United States that was crystallized best, arguably, by the historian Hiram Martin Chittenden, who wrote the book The American Fur Trade of the Far West in 1903, and it was the first study of the life and character of mountain men. There were novels about mountain men, like I said, in the 1830s and 1840s, but this is a proper history of them, and this led to the perception of them that went on for decades and decades and decades. So the result depicted the fur trade as a romanticized economic and even imperialistic movement and a critical stage in America's development, where mountain men are the advance guard of the progress of America's manifest destiny. And Chittenden was a full believer in manifest destiny, and he saw the fur trade men as important contributors to American democracy. They weren't bound to maintain a social station and live according to their birth, but instead they ventured west to pursue opportunities economically. Chittenden was interested in the romantic aspects of history and admired the heroic and adventurous nature of mountain men that he thought exemplified 19th century American industry. His view of them was that they were individualist, heroic agents, and model citizens. Of the Far West fur trade and the type of men who were involved in it, Chittenden wrote, "The nature of this business determined the character of the early white population. It was the roving trader and the solitary white trapper who first sought out these inhospitable wilds, traced the streams to their sources, scaled the mountain passes, and explored a boundless expanse of territory where the foot of the white man had never trodden before. The Far West became a field of romantic adventure and developed a class of men who loved the wandering career of the native inhabitant rather than the toilsome lot of the industrial colonist. The type of life thus developed into a distinct and necessary phase in the growth of this new country. Abounding in incidents picturesque and heroic, its annals inspired an interest akin to that which belongs to the age of knight-errantry. For the free hunter of the Far West was, in his rough way, a good deal of a knight-errant. Comparisons in the wild attire of the Indian, an armed cap-a-pie for instant combat, he roamed far and wide, leading a life in which every footstep was beset with enemies and every moment pregnant of peril. All in all, the period of this adventurous business may justly be considered the romantic era of the history of the West." So I want to telescope out even further and say why this idea of the mountain man as the distillation of the American spirit is important. That's because, really since the foundation of the United States, historians have been arguing about what America is. What is the collective identity that unites people from Maine down to Florida, especially at a time before mass communications when people are spread over a very wide geography, many of them coming from different national backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. What's the character that unites them together? Well, there are a lot of ideas about what this is. One of the earliest ideas came from George Bancroft. He was a New England preacher's son, turned Harvard-educated historian statesman, and he was the first to come up with a compelling story of American nationhood. And this was disseminated in his popular 10-volume History of the United States. This was written from 1854 to 1878. So he describes a unified, God-chosen nation destined to bring liberty to all humanity. But there were other competing narratives for what the United States was. One came from William Gilmore Sims. He was a Southern man who wrote his works in the antebellum period, and he was the South's leading man of letters. He argued that Bancroft's vision and the equality promised by the Declaration of Independence were all a sham. Ideas of liberty weren't what united the United States together. He said it was an alliance of ethno-states established for the allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race. He had a racial view of American history, and that other races were inferior, so a caste system with slavery was correct, not only correct, but necessary with the United States. Now, there are other views that come down the pike. One is Frederick Douglass, who was a challenger to both Bancroft and Sims, and as a fugitive slave, a former slave, he knew firsthand that the United States had not yet received equality and liberty for all, and there were parts of the United States in the South that did live according to a caste system. But he argued that liberty was a check written by the Declaration of Independence, and it merely needed to be cashed. And Abraham Lincoln agreed with him, and he was usually inspired by Frederick Douglass. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Other views, Woodrow Wilson, he is sort of like a neo William Gilmore Sims, who was the first Southerner elected to the presidency since the Civil War, and a white supremacist. His father was a religious leader in the Confederacy. Under Wilson, the federal government was resegregated, and he screamed Birth of a Nation in the White House. And his vision was dethroned in the 1960s by the Civil Rights Movement. But anyway, I want to turn to one last person who's given an idea for what makes for the collective idea of the United States, and that fits into our discussion of mountain men. And that is Frederick Jackson Turner. He was a friend of Woodrow Wilson and a famous scholar in his age. Turner was known for his frontier thesis, the idea that America wasn't shackled from the feudalism of the old world, its class system, aristocracy, its serfs, its different laws for different people. He said America instead had become a free and egalitarian society. And this happened because the United States was forged on the frontier. So this was an update of Bancroft's story. And there were flaws that even Turner himself realized that it didn't account for regional differences. But this view of the frontier thesis remained popular and it was taught in schools probably into the 1970s and 1980s. And this is where mountain men come in. Turner advocated his frontier thesis in 1893 and argued that American democracy was formed by the frontier. The frontier wasn't just happenstance and something that was incidental to the United States, but the ideas of liberty and democracy couldn't have happened without the frontier. So he stressed that American democracy was the result of a lack of interest in high culture and also in violence. American democracy was... American democracy, he said, it didn't come from the Mayflower to Plymouth Rock. It came from the American forest, he wrote, and it gained new strength each time it touched the frontier. So the American frontier established liberty because it released Americans from European mindsets and it freed them from dysfunctional customs. With the frontier, there wasn't a need for established churches or aristocrats or nobles or standing armies. There was no need for landed gentry who controlled most of the land when land was freely and cheaply available and anyone could claim it. Because of this, there are no heavy rents and fees charged by the land. Turner announced his thesis in a paper called The Significance of the Frontier in American History, which was delivered in 1893 in Chicago, and his theory was immediately popular. He elaborated on the theme in lectures and a series of essays over the next 25 years. His emphasis on the frontier in shaping American character spread like wildfire through universities, and by the 1930s, about 60% of history departments in the United States were teaching courses in frontier history along the lines that were set by Turner. So he says that the Western frontier line, which had defined all of American history from the arrival of the first settlers up to the 1880s, was coming to an end when he wrote. And he thought this was dangerous because American institutions were unique because they had to adapt themselves to the changing of expanded people, to crossing a continent, taming a wilderness, and developing each area of this progress out of primitive economic and political conditions. He said American progress had repeatedly undergone a cyclical process on the frontier as a society needed to redevelop with its movement westward. Everything in American history up to the 1880s relates to the Western frontier, including slavery. He thought of the frontier line as what caused Americanization. And he described the frontier line as what separates civilization from wilderness. He said it takes the European from across the Atlantic and shapes him into something new. American emigration west is not spurred by government incentives, but rather some expansive power inherent within them that seeks to dominate nature. And to Turner, the longer that America lived with its frontier, the longer that it affected society, even if people weren't in the frontier itself. So what started with the era of Thomas Jefferson and the idea of an Enlightenment-affected liberty, where Jefferson is very much a man of the East Coast and a large estate and refinement, over a few decades that turns into Jacksonian democracy, where you have somebody who grew up in the rugged hills of the Tennessee, who didn't have any kind of formal education, was very much a man of the people, and there's a much more populist type of democracy. This comes about because of the individualism that's fostered by the frontier wilderness and how it changed the national spirit of the United States. So Andrew Jackson's type of popular democracy couldn't have existed in Europe at all. It was purely an American invention. For Turner, the East and the West Coast were opposing forces, where the East wants to bring in and import some of the traditions of Europe, and the West wants nothing but freedom. So the British tried to stifle Western emigration during the colonial period and exert control. And even after independence, the East Coast tried to control the West, and religious institutions from the Eastern Seaboard tried to control the religious institutions and denominations in the West. The tensions between these churches resulted in the splitting and fracturing of denominations that he saw in his day in the 1890s. Turner said that the American intellect owes its form to the frontier as well. The traits of the frontier are, he wrote, coarseness and strength combined with acuteness and inquisitiveness, that practical, inventive turn of mind, quick to find expedients, that masterful grasp of material things, lacking in the artistic but powerful to effect great ends, that restless, nervous energy, that dominant individualism, working for good and for evil, and with all that buoyancy and exuberance which comes from freedom. And this was a constant evolutionary phase, where the first settlers that arrived in the 17th century acted like Europeans. Successive generations moved further inland, shifting the lines of settlement and wilderness, but still felt the tension of Europeanness and this new emerging American identity. But over time, European characteristics fall by the wayside, and the established churches and aristocracies and standing armies and intrusive government are increasingly out of place. With each generation moving further west and becoming more American, as he thinks, and more democratic and intolerant of hierarchy, people also become more distrustful of authority, more individualistic, even more violent, less scientific, and more dependent on ad hoc organizations. When Turner wrote in 1890, this is when the U.S. Census announced that the frontier had closed, and he was worried about what this meant for the continuing dynamism of American society, because American innovation and even democracy itself could disappear. Well, lots of people took up this thesis and said that even if there were no more land frontiers in America, there were others. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said that Social Security was a frontier that remains unconquered, an America unreclaimed. This is the nationwide frontier of insecurity, of human want and fear. This is the frontier, the America we have set out to reclaim. When John F. Kennedy talked about the space race, he recalled these ideas of the frontier, and in his acceptance speech, after securing the Democratic Party nomination in 1960, he said, "I'm asking each of you to be new pioneers on that new frontier. My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age, to the stout in spirit, regardless of party." So he was focusing on technology and space exploration. So there you go. I mean, I think the idea is hammered home about this idea of the frontier thesis. I mean, it was criticized by Turner. Many people argued that the frontier was experienced by different populations of the United States in very different ways. As the frontier continues to move west, it impacts fewer and fewer parts of America. So it's interesting in limited ways, but it's not a unifying grand theory of the United States, is what critics of Turner would say. But all that to say, why the frontier thesis of America had the most currency and why I spent so much time talking about it, I think you can understand why so many people regarded the mountain man as the purest distillation of what the United States is, that he is free, he's independent, he has to improvise, he's violent, that's a negative tendency, he isn't beholden to institutions, he's not submissive, he makes for a lot of trouble, but he, more than a cowboy, more than a competitive food eater, more than assistant to the regional manager, is the profession that is the purest distillation of what the United States is. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thanks for sticking with me all the way to the end. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Frazza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my Spy Masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.